top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, Mario Bava's Hatchet for the Honeymoon.
And I gotta say, it's wonderful to be back in Bava territory.
It is, indeed. L'accetta per la luna miele. The axe for the honeymoon. Yeah, I didn't realize that honeymoon is the same in Italian. Luna di miele, the moon of honey, which is like just a beautiful term. I don't know what its origins are, but and really, this is a beautiful movie. And a beautiful setting featuring beautiful people.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny, because right away you say this is a beautiful movie, and I mean, saying that a Bava film is beautiful is almost like saying water is wet. I mean, it almost goes without saying that his films are beautiful. I mean, the man was a master of composition. The man was a master of mise-en-scene and, you know, use of color. And even if his films were black and white, like Black Sunday, whatever, it doesn't matter. The man knew how to make something striking. And he did it on minimal budgets, minimal time, and he always did it right. And this film starts out right with just an incredible credit sequence, which is bursts of color, technicolor. Now, there was a little, I would say, I guess you want to call it a typo, I don't know, that kind of made me laugh. I think it meant to say brides were designed by, but it actually said brides were, two words.
Yeah, yeah.
Brides were designed by. So that was kind of funny because, I mean, technically, I mean, the brides were designed by whomever this was because they designed the brides' wear.
Fair point.
But the credit sequence was wonderful. Bava himself was the one that designed those credit sequences.
Wow.
And it just, the beauty just begins right from the get-go and just continues on throughout the
and
film.
And we'd be remiss if, I mean, as genre fans, we'd be just thrilled to the tits to see the words Lamberto Bava as well, who is the assistant director on this. So
I'm
you
not
see
the
brides
tits.
Were.
Have you ever seen any Lamberto solo films?
Apart from
say
Demons?
The apple kind of Demons was good, but I mean, you know,
the apple always falls really far from the tree. I don't know, like Jacob Dylan. No, thank you.
You didn't like The Wallflowers?
No.
I'm not ashamed to say that I actually bought their CD.
Randy Bachman's Son.
I've subsequently sold it, but back in the day I did like it.
Yeah, She's So High, Randy Bachman's Son.
I'm trying to wax poetically about The Wallflowers.
Oh,
I wanted to sing like a verse of One Headlight at this moment.
You would have to try because it's next to impossible. But but hey.
Oh my God, remember the god-awful cover of Heroes for the that Godzilla soundtrack?
Oh good God.
Yeah.
This is, you have this wonderful The Man Who Sold the World LP here, and as big a Bowie fan as you are, like, yeah, that is sullying our eardrums with that just oral horror show.
Never mind, though, but David Bowie's son, Duncan Jones, I mean, he's a fairly talented filmmaker in his own right.
Oh,
so
really?
Maybe that's a secret. Maybe
you have to do a different genre.
Exactly.
What about George Harrison's useless son, Danny? Who would just, as I complain to you, I don't know, we're off on a little tangent here, but all he does is strum a fucking acoustic guitar. He doesn't sing. I don't know what the hell he did. Like, is he a songwriter? I don't know. What does he do?
He's a Harrison. That's what he does.
That's all you need.
That's what he gets paid for.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
And don't get me started on Yoko Ono's kid, but anyway, we digress. Wonderful. You go from the credits to this pop of Technicolor. You're looking at it going, where is this going to go? This is all red all over the place, and yet this is a giallo.
But is it a giallo? That's something I wanted to discuss.
Is it a giallo?
Yeah, because I wanted to actually kind of bring this up maybe later on in the podcast, but yes, it's a giallo. I mean, I consider it to be a giallo, but by its very definition, a giallo is a murder mystery, right?
Yeah,
a whodunit.
Or they keep the cards close to their chest with a black glove killer. Who is that? Here it's, well, we know who it is.
Right from the very outset,
yeah.
There's a man who breaks into a train compartment, kills two lovers with a hatchet, great camera trickery and so on, which again is stock and trade of Bava. And then we get a voiceover, and it's our hero, I guess you want to say, John. And he's saying, I am a paranoiac. That's what he called himself.
Yeah,
that's
a word. Yeah.
He goes, the fact is, I'm completely mad. So it's not a giallo in the purest sense of the word, in the sense that it's a whodunit who's committing these murders. There was not one black glove in the entire movie.
No.
But it's a giallo. I mean, it feels like a giallo to me. So yes, it is
a giallo. Yeah, I guess to quote other bad music, I guess it wasn't all yellow, to quote Coldplay. But anyway, look at this. You're disgusted with me now. But yeah, it's
sometimes
it's
I wish this was a video podcast as opposed to an audio podcast, so then people could see my reactions to what you're saying. I'm just shaking my head.
Oh, yeah, as you mentioned, yeah, he's a self-described paranoiac. And I thought this was great because he's got this little monologue going saying that he's so civilized, so full of possibilities, and yet he's afflicted with this condition. This includes, you know, suffering from an Oedipal complex, the Freudian complex, where you obviously identify with one parent, sexually and otherwise. So he's got all this kind of, this baggage that we're introduced to through voiceover, which can be a cheesy device, but here is handled really well.
It's cool. I mean, it's rather existential, really, because he talks about his murders and why he does it. And he says, you know, the existence of death makes life ridiculous. And that is...
That's like existentialism in a nutshell.
That's Camus. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, right there. I mean, Camus said that we have to, in order to give our life on this earthly plane any sort of authenticity and meaning, we have to rally against the concept of an afterlife. Because if all we're doing is living for the promise of something greater beyond that we don't even know empirically exists, then this life means nothing, and what we do means nothing because we're not doing it authentically. We're doing it for the promise of greater reward.
Oh my God.
I'm sorry for elevating the podcast.
Camus can do, but Sartre is smartra. I'll bring it down for you. No, but that's incredibly true. Like, it's rare that you see. I mean, we always laugh at the mommy issues horror movie, whether it's Don't Answer the Phone or Maniac, although we don't laugh at that, but there's a certain trope that comes with the genre.
This film had a little Maniac vibe to it.
It certainly did. But the self-awareness that this movie has versus Don't Answer the Phone, like this guy, he's coping with this internal struggle of these impulses that he just cannot, that this can't help but express themselves. And I guess his position as the overseer of this house of couture isn't cutting it. I guess, I don't know.
It's the Harrington House.
Yeah, and I guess he has to, I don't know, but that plays into it. So he's kind of got this, it's set in Paris, so it's got this weird Yves Saint Laurent kind of high fashion vibe. Although Harrington House is, as the title would suggest, specializing in wedding dresses.
Bride's
werewolf. That's a really interesting and funny and, dare I say, typically Italian conceit, because you get this opportunity to have this guy being surrounded by beauty and lushness and aesthetic, you know, wonders, and he's getting up to this really dirty business of killing some of his models, and this is set against the backdrop of this spacious, fantastic villa. This was filmed in, I believe, maybe Madrid and Rome, but it's set in Paris. But it doesn't matter. I mean, immaculately cared for grounds.
Actually, I quickly gleaned IMDb before that. The home that they filmed this in, it was in Spain. It used to be the domicile of General Franco.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Usually those dictators have terrible taste, so I'm impressed. You know, I look at no further than Mussolini.
I may be mistaken.
Or Saddam Hussein, yeah.
I'm 90% sure.
Yeah, gorgeous surroundings, Yves Saint Laurent couture stylings, these beautiful models, these beautiful gowns, these beautiful dresses, and this guy.
And his beautiful wife.
Yeah.
Not so much.
Not so much, no.
Because John is married, he's betrothed to a woman named Mildred, who is a bit of a battle axe, I would say.
Yeah. Well, speaking of hatchets, yeah. Well, she's a fantastic foil, I was going to say, to him, because this is, again, typically Italian, like, she just refuses to divorce him and says, no matter what you say or whatever fights we get into, I'm going to be here, because it turns out she is bankrolling the entire exercise, and he needs her more than she needs him, really. So, and she lords it over him, saying, you know, without me, you don't have this, you know, cash cow. Mm-hmm. So this is very funny. And, you know, this tension between the two is fantastic. And that's what plays out throughout the whole movie, as this guy who has a wandering eye obviously starts to, you know, seek out more of, you know, companionship through some of his models.
So in addition to being a the supposed head of this bridal boutique, what have you, fashion house. Yeah. But, yeah. He's also a bit of a
horticulturist.
Yeah. A bit of a florist. And as these brides start to go missing, because that's his MO, is he kills either brides or models that are modeling the brides for him.
Yeah.
I think it's basically because when one of them says, I'm going to get married, that's when he's now on his radar to off.
Yeah.
And that brings the inspectors. And they, I believe when he first meets the inspector, he's in his
hothouse flowers.
He's in his greenhouse, yeah. And they have this kind of witty repartee back and forth. You know, it's this standard repartee when, like, each one sort of feels like, oh, I kind of get the sense of what this guy's up to, and I'm going to one-up him, and so on. And the inspector mentions how beautiful the flowers are. What's your secret? And he says,
fertilizer.
The right type of fertilizer. Yeah. Now, this was something that was not expanded upon as the film continued, but he had different ways of dealing with the corpses. Sometimes he would bury them. Sometimes he would burn them. And then it made me think, like, is that part and parcel of the fertilizer that...
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It was a Hitchcockian little element, and he did have, like, a little incinerator, well, a large incinerator that he used, but not, again, for every killing, but it was just, a nice little subtle Hitchcock drop of just a little tiny, cool piece of, like, little verbal trickery. And I liked the analog of the horticulture thing. It would be like a perfect hobby for a guy whose business is, as he describes it, alterations. So with hothouse flowers, you take, presumably, hopefully you'll correct me, you take different varietals and you match them and you come up with like beautiful flowers. I don't know.
I have no clue about that.
This is a man who has not a single plant in his entire apartment. Oh my God.
I got fake black flowers over there, but...
No fake plastic trees for Radiohead. But yeah, like my apartment is full of flowers. Since the girlfriend moved in.
I haven't been to your apartment ever since. So.
There's something, it's a good counterpoint too, because obviously when you're going around murdering people as part of your daily business, you have to have some kind of, all the contingencies that it brings.
The last time I went to your apartment, you barely had a plate. Now it's full of flowers. What is going on here?
I don't know. I'm blooming. I'm blossoming. But yeah, it's something over which you have control. So it's a wonderful thematic counterpoint. One part of his life, completely out of control. His shitty marriage. His wife who refuses to divorce him. His trying to off as many models as possible with his cleaver, and then the solitude, the quiescence, the quietude, if that's a word, of his greenhouse and tending to his flowers in peace and quiet contemplation. I thought that was really cool. And then, yeah, again, like the inspector goes on this big, aside about alterations and, hey, this is your business, and he draws attention to it. And I thought that was really cool. There's a love interest of this John, the operator of this fashion house, and she goes by the name of Helen, and she's played by Dagmar Lassinger, who, and this is is a character in We Are Still Here, apparently. That movie didn't stick with my memory banks, but a tribute to the actor's name was in that movie. So they have this kind of little banter between them. She thinks there's more to it than there is. They meet in a clandestine kind of, they're having an affair in this restaurant. And I thought that was really well done, because he actually had a real human connection with this model in a way that he really didn't with the others. Mm. And she comes to play...
Nor his wife.
This is true as well. And she comes to play a really important role in the denouement.
Which
we're not going to spoil. So,
however, midway through this film, I guess this is a mild spoiler, he does kill Mildred. He kills his wife. Or does he? Because the rest of the movie is him trying to sort of move past it, and yet everybody seems to be speaking or seeing his dead wife in a, you know, the bride wore black, in a black veil and whatnot. And so here we have this man who at the beginning, even though he's a paranoid and he knows that he's mad, he's going even further into a descent into madness, because now everybody's seeing his dead wife.
But him. What a great conceit, because you'd expect the opposite, and we've seen the opposite tons of times. And the fact that other people are involved just makes it so really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I love that scene. And you're fine for spoiling it, but the death, or was it the death of his wife? And she's lying at the top of a stairwell.
There were so many amazing moments.
Oh my God, this was great.
He killed her while wearing a bridal veil.
Yeah.
That just added a little extra patina of...
But was he wearing blue or something borrowed as well?
I don't know. Was this the murder when he brought the hatchet on a silver platter?
Yes.
And you could see her reflection in the hatchet. Yeah. And she knows what's going to about to
She knew it was coming. And
the inspectors come as she's... Before her body's been disposed of, she's lying there.
At the top of the stairwell. Down. Yeah.
And they hear screams. He attributes it to a horror movie that's playing on TV. What is the horror movie? Black Sabbath.
Excellent.
The Vrdulak. The Vrdulak sequence of Black Sabbath.
And there's two showstopper scenes, but this is one of them. The drip. Drip. What's with Bava and his dripping and his noises and his punctuating scenes with like ticking clocks and like... Man, this is sensational. Like,
very, very Edgar Allan Poe with a telltale heart.
This was so cool. So you get the cops at the door. Obviously, John is trying to get rid of them. And there's the tension of whether they will see or hear, I guess, the drop onto the carpet of his, you know, deceased wife's blood as she's exsanguinating on the top of the stairwell. Like, man, what an awesome, awesome scene. And it's just, this film is so full of these kinds of things. I was thinking of the first kill on the train. I mean, we've both gone on long-haul train rides through Europe and through Asia. And what a great setting where you have like this confined space inside another confined space. Mm-hmm. I was thinking Terror Train, like Jamie Lee Curtis. Like, there's nowhere to run to, nowhere to hide. And what can you do? Like, you're just stuck. And then the screech of the train going by as the cut...
ounce of willpower and resistance for me not to burst into Martha and the Vandellas in that
from
moment.
From the
you said, yeah.
Yeah, but that was so well done. And again, yeah, so we could quibble as to what extent or how yellow this is, because you see an actual hand that's not
clad in
a glove. Mm-hmm. We know from the get-go, because it's, well, explained right off the bat that the guy is full of possibilities, and yet he must, quote, John, he must go on wielding the cleaver. So he's just compelled to keep doing this. And yet, this gives us some of the little hints of the giallo, but not full giallo.
So I think this would be a good time in the podcast to discuss what we've learned.
For fans of, I guess, the incredible 1970s version of Dracula, you'll recognize probably the inspector. I believe his name is Juan Puentes. He's a longtime Spanish genre actor. He's terrific as the inspector here. And just brings a lot of just class and gravitas to the role. Mm-hmm. And the cat and mouse game between him and John is really fantastic. Gotta love the delusions that he suffers, where you have all these other people seeing his wife and not him, and whether it's at a restaurant or having these other sort of little engagements. I thought that was really, really cool, really interesting. What did you learn?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it's always easy. I mean, this film came out in 1970. It's always easy, 40 plus years hence, you know, look back at a film and make fun of some of the sartorial choices and stuff. I don't make fun of them because I love the fashion of the 70s. I love the fashion of the 80s. I wish I could still dress, that it was still acceptable to go, for example, if you're a lawyer, to go to a courtroom with like massive mutton chop sideburns and a giant afro and you know, wide lapels and what have you.
Yeah.
There's a scene because, you know, this is a man who, you know, because of his wife, he's a man of means. So breakfast is outdoors, and they have a maid who serves them tea and so on. And, you know, he reads the paper and whatnot, and him and his wife have their little banter back and forth, you know, their hustle banter. Post-murder, there's a scene where he's sitting there reading his paper, sipping his tea, and he's sitting there in this, I don't even know how to describe it, this black and white sort of zebra-striped lounge jumper one piece, which is the most 70s thing I've ever seen anybody wear in a movie, and it was glorious.
Oh, well.
If I could get my hands on that particular item of clothing, I would buy it, I would wear it, and I would never stop. It was glorious.
Hey, it's la moda italiana. It's Italian fashion. Even for the 70s, it's wide lapels were not as wide as they were wide here. Like, it's still friggin' stylish as all hell. There's a reason all these places like emerge out of Milan, and that when you're surrounded by like so much beauty, Stendhal syndrome, like you're just, Italy is just the most beautiful place on earth, and you can't help but have that inform everything, whether it's your cars, your Ferrari and Lamborghini, the sleekness, your futurist art movements, the Renaissance painters, your Raffaello, all these guys, like the entire culture is so infused with this beauty, and I liked seeing it here in the fashion sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, whoa, what a beautiful movie.
So, and just getting back to the, you know, like, okay, this is not a giallo proper, no black love killer, no mystery as to who done it, although there is mystery later on as to, mm-hmm. you know, what's causing all these delusions and so on. Is she really alive? Is she not? Etc. Really, it's rather, I would say, a portrait of a deranged mind. And there is a lot of similarities to Maniac in the sense that there's mannequins.
Well, yeah, yeah.
And dancing with mannequins, affection with mannequins, etc.
I would say his sartorial choices are far and above, you know, Joe Spinell's in that movie. But yeah.
Yet again, another one of my fashion icons, Joe Spinell.
Well, your penchant for black t-shirts, for sure. I could see that.
Come on, man. That amazing jacket he was wearing in Rocky and those aviator shades. Oh, God, Joe Spinell. How I miss you so.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just want to talk a bit more about Mario Bava. I mean, he's always considered to be part of the holy trinity of Italian genre cinema, along with Dario Argento and Lucio Fulci. I'm not going to say who's better, who's... They're all amazing. But in comparison to those two, his films are rather genteel. They're not these grand Guignol gore fest spectacles like Fulci would make, or, you know, Argento as well. They're always, later on in his career, his films did get a wee bit more vicious, a little less stylistic, a little bit more, I'm thinking like Bay of Blood and stuff. Rabid Dogs, I believe, is another one.
He was just probably reflecting the times or just trying to mirror them as the times were changing around him. I mean, Hitchcock suffered the same, well, I don't want to say suffered, he followed the same trajectory as well. So mm-hmm. who knows if they had both been making movies in the 80s, what they would have been doing.
But Bava has, I mean, yes, okay, his films are a little bit more genteel. You're not going to get this this gore fest from point, you know, from the beginning to the end, whatever. But what you have is style. What you have is craft. And in the hands of Mario Bava, the man is a master. It doesn't matter if he's doing sci-fi, like Planet of the Vampires. It doesn't matter if he's doing a sword and sandal movie like Hercules in the Haunted World. There's always going to be a feast for the senses. And this one is no exception.
I spoke earlier about one of two quintessential, just breathtaking, amazing scenes. You have to give the highest kudos to the incredible floating scene where his deceased wife just emerges from the bottom of the stairs and just like gradually comes up into frame and then scares the bejesus out of him. I thought that was so amazingly handled and so cool and so awesome. I mean, but that's, you could just pick any 10-minute interval and find just some breathtaking vista. Mm-hmm. So yes, so the eatable stuff is kind of silly. The fact that, I mean, they don't really as effectively tie together his, I guess, antipathy towards marriage and how it expresses itself, manifests itself in his vengeance that he's taking out on these brides. I mean, you can only, you know, be so embittered about your own marriage to, you know, that it seems a little bit of a silly, you know, thread to draw between them, but it was fun. I mean, it was Italian, it's silly, it's kind of dumb, and you buy into it. And the mommy issue stuff, it's also fun. Like, he's got the voice in his head. I think there's a flashback to his mother engaged in sexual behavior that he flat, which
and
is
we've never
for
seen
course.
That before. In
no,
films
well,
ever.
Yeah, of course, and I love that kind of stuff as well. And so, I mean, they played up a lot of it, and people will throw in the allusions to Psycho. You can throw in your allusions to Maniac, but I think in turn, oh hell, don't answer the phone as well with the character who's, in that case, he had daddy issues, but there's someone who's breaking down mentally, and it's something maybe you would not have seen very much of at the time. So I thought it was kind of novel that he would introduce such Freudian, like kind of Jungian kind of dynamics into what is on the surface of it just some stock and slash of models in a beautiful locale, mm-hmm. which it could have very well been.
For sure. So star rating for Hatchet for the Honeymoon.
Oh my God. Jeez. Well, I love like how dismissive he is of the investigative officers, and really, why wouldn't you be? Because as we've seen with real life cases, how the police handle these things, their investigative, prowess is not exactly top drawer.
If Giallos have done nothing else, they made inspectors in Italy or in Europe in the 60s and 70s
like Clouseau.
Look like the most inept, bumbling idiots. That's one of the legacies of the Giallo film.
Oh, the carabinieri look really bad here. And they don't even, they have nothing really to pin on him other than the fact that his models go, what does that have to do with him? The fact that he runs a fashion house and models go missing.
Yeah,
like if
your pattern starts to develop.
I suppose. Yeah. If you're Bill Gates and software developers go missing from Seattle, or you suddenly hauled in before like a, an inspector, kind of ridiculous. And also there was a, I believe is it the brother of one of the deceased or maybe the fiance? No, I believe it's the fiance. And he was brought to the house of John. And I'm not
making
a joke.
It almost sounds like Game of Thrones.
Oh, no, it's like the house of John. It's a fashion house, but mm-hmm. also to his literal house. And in what planet, in what universe would you bring someone to a suspect's house if you're a cop? Like, isn't that the most absurd thing? Like, you're investigating someone, you bring along, like, someone who has a hunch. And, like, why would you knock at the door with, like, oh, by the way, this is the fiancé. He thinks you did it. Like, that's bizarre. Like, he should, I don't know, JonBenet Ramsey? Would you go to, like, the door of the father with the mother and go, like, oh, I got you now? It's so absurd. But, yeah.
I love the fact that I asked you for your star rating. You went off on this hilarious tangent. That's just great. So,
well, it's some shitty-ass fucking police work.
Right.
Like, and they had nothing on him. They had nothing on this guy. He just... So what? Models? They didn't even have any video or photo evidence of him having a dalliance with one of these models. They'd investigated none of that because, as we all know, love triangles are the cause of many a murder. They had nothing on this guy. And they just show up.
Chris,
I don't know.
I did not know that asking for star rating would get you so enraged. So let's.
I'm so mad. I'm gonna take a meat cleaver and like, chop you up. No. I'm gonna give this 3.25 star. Like, beautiful visuals. Maybe not Bava wielding his, camera at his finest at his peak, which would have been, I guess, the Black Sunday, Black Sabbath kind of. Who knows? I really love fucking Bay of Blood. Upon revisiting it for the second time, like how influential that was. So yeah, maybe lesser Bava is still Bava Majoris or whatever you want to call
indeed,
it. 3.5 star.
Yeah, I mean, this is not. If somebody says to me, "Oh, I want to get to the cinema of Mary Bava, where should I start?" I would never say, "Oh, Hatchet for the Honeymoon." This is something you watch after you've watched, the classics, right? But, I remember reading something about the Beatles where they said, like, even the Beatles' worst song is better than most bands' best song. Well, that's not entirely true, because one of the worst songs by the Beatles, as far as I'm concerned, is not Revolution No. 9. It's a song by my favorite Beatle, George Harrison. It all comes back together, because we were talking about Danny earlier, called Long, 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 off the White Album, which, by the way, is my favorite Beatles album.
Revolver here, but, yeah. Speaking of murder weapons, but, yeah.
So I'm not going to say that Bad Bava is better than other filmmakers' best, nor am I going to say this is Bad Bava. This is just middle of the road Bava. Yeah. So yeah, 3.25 is completely appropriate as far as I'm concerned.
Brava, bravura, Bava. I would say, if I may. I really also like the little touch before we close here of the do not disturb sign left on the door of some of the victims. It's just like a neat little, like, it's just par for the course in giallo to have these little tiny nuggets, these breadcrumbs of fun, you know, linking together all these different murders. And this is something that in the hands of someone lesser you wouldn't get, and you're certainly not going to get it in the myriad Friday the 13th movies. You don't have these little touch of class, and Bava is all about class from top to bottom, as are we, really, right?
Our podcast. Are we really?
Not really. We try and exude a patina of class, but we're really, you know, down in the gutter looking up at the stars, Fort Wilde. Yeah, check out our podcast every Friday, new episodes, genre films like giallo. We're going to cover more giallo in the future because I'm just scratching the surface of some of Bava's work, and I've you know, I'm much more familiar with the Argento stuff. But man, this is such a deep well to dive down. So I'm so excited.
You just want to keep using that stupid Coldplay joke over and over and over again. That's true. Why you want to do your giallo.
Well, I'm a journalist. Maybe I'll bring out a yellow journalism reference. But there's more yellow to come, and there's more fun genre and horror chat to come on the Really Awful Movies podcast. Send us your suggestions. Really Awful Movies at gmail.com, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.